from the UW Anthro Department, ladies and gentlemen, Professor Cecil Schrader, with startling new news, if you can have new news, newer news, about Cahokia.
From the population study?
Oh, boy, here we go. Starting right with the poop, right down to the bottom. I'm trying to elevate the caliber of this program. And because you dig around in the dirt all the time, that's where you want to take it.
Of course, that's where we make these amazing discoveries about ancient worlds.
Ancient worlds, yes. And it started where, in Kentucky?
That was where my first tenure track job was.
And you're still in touch with the Kentucky dig out there, isn't it?
Yes. So I still have a project based in Western Kentucky.
Yeah, Western Kentucky. And what's that one called?
The Jonathan Creek Project. So it's about a site that's probably time-wise begins to emerge around the same time that Cahokia declines. And I got interested in it because of the... It seemed to me to be a really nice comparative example to Cahokia, a somewhat smaller community, but still had multiple mounds, had a wall built around at least part of it. In fact, it had many walls built in sequence around it. And Cahokia had walls built around the central precinct. Mm-hmm. And I was really kind of interested in comparing the nature of those walls.
You're into walls? Is that the major focus?
I like to build walls between me and other people.
That's what I was doing, actually. I think you do the opposite. You actually look for walls. Walls are very important because you're into architecture.
I'm into ancient architecture.
Yeah.
And walls can signify
a lot of styles of construction, just even among the Mississippians.
Yes, they're usually illustrated as if all of their houses were constructed the same, but they had multiple approaches to constructing houses, different kinds of foundations, different kinds of roofs, making use of whatever locally available materials there might be.
Yeah.
They didn't vary a whole lot in size. They tended to be pretty much single-family dwellings that might be the size of this room that we're sitting in.
Yeah,
and that's where a family would live.
Because, you know, I was disappointed by an artist's depiction of Cahokia, because these amazing mound constructions, biggest in the world, amazing. How they did that is another question, but they were tabletop for a structure like this, and the structures were just these. They showed huts with grass roofs. They were beyond that, weren't they? Cahokia, these people are amazing.
They are really amazing, and the structures were. The roofs may have been grass, they might have been bark. That material doesn't preserve very well.
Nothing.
In fact, most of the architecture, other than the mounds, was made of perishable materials. And so we have to try and figure out what kinds of materials they used. And the best avenue to that is when a structure burned. And some of those materials end up being preserved because they're charred. But that gives us an idea of what one structure looked like. And by analogy, we sometimes overextend and think that all structures looked the same.
Yeah. But there's the peasants, and then there's the big shots. And wasn't that for that giant mound? What do they call that mound?
Monk's Mound.
Monk's Mound. Was that for, like, the emperor or whatever it was, or the head dude?
Certainly for the community leader, the chief, and it probably was a facility that also involved rituals, religious practices. It may have been multi-purpose.
Did they do all that stuff in the king's house there? Or whatever?
So they may have. That's the structure on top of Monk's Mound.
Then I wouldn't want
really
the job.
Special.
Then I don't want the job.
You don't want the job.
First, it sounds good. Nice view. But they do the actual slaughtering people in your house is...
Oh, they didn't do that necessarily. There's certainly evidence of sacrificial victims, but that was done in different contexts, not necessarily in the house of somebody.
Okay, good. Well,
like the chief.
Sorry, I got the wrong idea. Bird. I have a picture of Birdman here.
Yes, you do.
I just love the way he looks. I would like to look like this, really. I might have the work done. That's so cool, Birdman. Who is Birdman?
So the falcons, other kinds of birds of prey that have hooked beaks, like the one that's illustrated there. That's a common motif associated with chiefs Mississippian society. So the birdman imagery plays out in a lot of different media in the culture at Cahokia and at other related Mississippian sites in the southeast, where an individual is part human and part bird.
And sometimes
they will, they're often portrayed with the beak, and then sometimes with clawed feet, bird claw feet, and then wings with feathers that are draped from them. And
But otherwise human.
And these
may have, not much left when you think about it.
Just two legs.
I mean, it all means something. You know, I got to see. Yeah. The proportions even are probably important understanding.
But birds, especially birds of prey, have an important role to play even among native cultures today. These are amazing creatures, and they are being treated with reverence through the birdman motifs and costumes.
Is it just the bird, or other animals represented?
So other animals are represented in the iconography, like snakes, owls, beavers, fish, so kind of a variety of different animals that had some sort of importance.
Yeah, but they're all fish. They're not half human.
They're usually all fish, all snake, all something like that.
So yes. Birdman is alone in his. Representing.
Yeah, the combination of human and bird. Traits.
Got a chunky player here.
Yes, I see that.
Chunky is the big game down there.
Yeah, Chunky was a really Chunky was a very important game among Mississippian societies, and it was still played in among historic tribes when they were first encountered by Anglo-Americans. And it's a game of incredible skill. You have this biconcave stone disc. And you roll it down field.
Bring one of those?
And I did not. I was going to. I was going to.
But you brought the poop, right?
I didn't bring the poop.
Really?
I have the poop, but not the poop.
You have the poop, but not... You mean the poop, the scoop?
The poop, the scoop.
The poop scoop, but not the actual
but
poop.
But not the actual poop. Okay. I didn't bring that with me.
Does anyone have that? Do you have some at home?
It's in a lab.
Okay. Does it look like?
It doesn't. No, it doesn't really look like it sounds.
Okay. It's a sample from the lake. We'll talk about it. Show me what you got here.
So you want to see?
I want to see the stuff.
You want to see some stuff?
You brought stuff.
I brought some things to show.
White gloves. Thank you. I've been looking for a pair. Is it a large? Perfect.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
I thought that might be your size.
You can't get these anymore.
You can't. They're probably toxic in some level or another. The material culture.
Oh, can I wear these too?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Absolutely.
That's the best part
Put
of this
them
show
on.
Ever. What? No one gives me gloves.
And why is that, Michael?
I don't know. You're the first person all years, putting a lot of years, waiting for a pair of white gloves. I look so good. I could be a cartoon. I'd have to lose a finger. Oh, I'm sorry.
So, the chunky stones.
In case I touch anything, I can. Sorry. Right
yeah, you can. You won't contaminate it.
Thank you so much. What do we got here?
So the first object that I brought is a hoe. This was for gardening.
Yeah, hold it right up there.
There we go.
Hoe it up right there.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So
that's a beautiful piece of work.
This is made out of a type of stone that we call Mill Creek Chert.
Yeah.
It is found in far southern Illinois, and it occurs in large pieces. And... This would have been hafted onto a stick or some other kind of handle, and it was used for gardening, but it was also used for digging the trenches that were part of the foundation of houses. So when they constructed their houses at Cahokia, most of those houses were constructed in a form we call wall trench architecture, where they excavated four trenches to form the exterior, the sort of foundation of the house, and then dropped prefabricated walls into those trenches and then tied the corners together.
They had prefabricators?
They did have prefabricators.
Okay, how about that?
Yes. Yeah. So it was a...
Do you remember the name of the company? Did they use them all over the Colombian...
We see them in it's a characteristic of Mississippian architecture throughout the southeastern United States.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, and sometimes this one doesn't show it, but sometimes the edge that was used for gardening will get a super high polish on it.
Sure.
It'll become super shiny, and that is mostly from working around the corn plants, because corn fronds have a lot of silica in them, and that. Mm. Leads to just super high polish on these objects.
So it wouldn't be from going through flesh and bone.
No. These were really important for
gardening. Okay. Do we have
and house construction.
Weapons that we found?
So there are weapons.
Yeah. Did you bring any cool weapons?
And I brought some arrow points.
Okay. Well, no, let's see more. Please show me the stuff here. Pottery looks amazing.
So we've got...
Thank you for bringing all this.
Well, thank you for asking.
Did you take the bus? Did you have to pay extra?
It was like having a whole other person on the bus.
Yeah.
So the primary weapon for hunting, but also for warfare, was the arrow. Mm-hmm. The arrow was innovated around AD 600.
Okay.
And Cahokia's, you know, sort of peak... peak political presence was about AD 1050 to about 1250.
1250, when it disappeared.
And it disappeared. It began to go in decline by 1100 to 1200, somewhere in there. It was late 1100s. It was going into decline. And it was essentially abandoned by 1350, 1400. At least archaeologically, if there's any human occupation left in the region, it has dropped below archaeological visibility. Mm-hmm. It means it's that the people are living in such widely scattered settlements, and they probably aren't staying in those settlements very long periods of time and throwing stuff away, because it's what we find is the trash and the poop.
Yeah, the good stuff.
The good stuff. Yeah. That's what we find.
That's what they'll find of us too, which is reassuring.
Yeah. So this is an arrow point made of chipped stone, and you can hold that.
It looks like a moth. I'll say it looks like a moth. Doesn't it?
It's very, very
beautiful.
Very tiny, but beautiful workmanship. Very thin, and these are, you know, just...
And this is all with... chipping.
Yes, with chipping, using stone and bone tools, perhaps even some copper-tipped tools.
Mm. Did you find any of the tools?
We find the hammer stones. So these are, you know, like cobbles that will fit in your hand that are used for the initial stages of reducing the stone down to something like this. Mm-hmm. And then after that, they used things like the tip of an antler from a...
Really?
From a, like a, is that a jackrabbit you have on the wall up
it's
there?
It's a jackalope.
Jackalope.
It's not a real
jackalope.
Animal. So someone brings us in from a dig, send them out the door.
So the tips of the antlers are a perfect tool for doing sort of really refined chipping on the edges of something like this.
Beautiful work.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have this here too, but I saw this thing that just amazed me, the quality of what they were trying to work with. Gloves on, I discovered. Can't really lick the end of it. Well, it's not there. Normally, I could just page through this and it would be. Well, it was their copper work.
Oh, yes. Yes. Beautiful copper work.
Yeah, beautiful copper. I wish I could show it to you, but I can't separate this. I don't think so. Wait a minute. Oh, here it is. Here it is.
The one sheet of paper you didn't touch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Look at this. That's amazing. Was this found at Cahokia or elsewhere?
No. So that's three different objects, one of which was found at a site called Etowah in Georgia, and I can't remember where the other two were found, but they were found in the southeast. Mm-hmm. And based on the style, the depiction of the bird person, especially on the central object, it's been connected to Cahokia, and so it's thought that these were crafted at Cahokia by artists there, and then
tag said made in Cahokia.
And then as the community was abandoned, people took these sacred bundles that may have contained these pieces of copper.
They were refugees from Cahokia.
And they were refugees, and then eventually they ended up being buried with or their descendants were buried with these copper objects.
Mm-hmm. But what are they for? Are they utilitarian or decorative? Or?
They were probably signs of status of some sort.
Okay.
Some people have suggested that they were part of a sacred bundle that would be worn on the head of a ritual leader or some other kind of leader. Other people have suggested that they were used in rituals, that they were, you know, important figures that were used in rituals. But it echoes that Birdman theme that we have associated with Cahokia.
Yeah, very interesting. We should start with a minute. This is the biggest city on Earth of its time that we know of, or at least in North America, in the Western world.
It's the largest one in North America.
Yeah.
And it at AD 11 or 1050, 1100, it was larger than London was at the same time. And the population estimates for Cahokia vary really widely. The peak population estimates vary from, you know, the high thousands, like, you know, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000, up to maybe 20,000. Mm-hmm. So there's a big range in how people have made the population estimates. And the work that we've been doing doesn't help us pin down how many people lived there, but it helps us look at the trajectory of population size in a relative sense. So when was the population at its highest, and when did it go into decline, and how does that decline relate to environmental changes, to paleoclimatological events and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it was an amazing place. This is a place that people, even living here in Wisconsin, they would have known about Cahokia.
Mm-hmm.
They would have known that there was this.
Aztalan?
Yes. So Aztalan was settled
by. Sister city or something?
It was settled in part by people who came from Cahokia.
Oh, okay.
And probably that settlement was selected because people from that community may have traveled to Cahokia and met people there and told them about their beautiful community on the banks of the Crawfish River, as we call it today. Mm-hmm. And so they came and joined them, or they may have been traveling. People from Cahokia may have been traveling out from the city into the distant hinterlands and came upon the location and the people living there and thought that it would be a great place to settle. But we see evidence of these connections to Cahokia into the far northern Wisconsin, the northern part of the lower peninsula of Michigan, west into Kansas, and south down into Louisiana, Mississippi. And these are direct connections or evidence of indirect connections, and it's mostly most of this knowledge of the distribution of or the movement of people tied to Cahokia comes from a very distinctive kind of pottery. And this is an example, a fragment of the top of a jar, and this one shows it a little bit better. This is it had a very distinctive form. It's very finely made, highly polished. It often has a brown or a black pigment that was applied to it.
And the line is very...
And then the lines, these incised lines.
It's like a cartoonist.
Lines.
You see that? Recognize that guy's line.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is distinctive to Cahokia. And
yeah,
the clays
beautiful.
That this was made out of are also distinctive to Cahokia.
Yeah.
And so we see these objects in really distant places. Mm-hmm. And we can look at them the clay under a microscope and see if it's the same as the clay from Cahokia.
And it is, oftentimes.
And a lot of times it is. And sometimes it isn't, and what we're looking at is a local imitation. Sometimes the incising...
A knockoff.
Sometimes the incising is done very crudely. Or sometimes it's done with equal skill, but it was done perhaps by somebody trained in the potting tradition at Cahokia who...
I took off my gloves.
Oh, you took off your gloves. Michael.
Yeah. That would have been our thing. You know, we would have been in the knockoff Cahokia pottery business.
That's what you would have done?
I'm just saying it probably would have fallen to us. Not that we couldn't have done other things, but it was open. This I don't know. Did I show this already? No. This is not very good, or the reproduction is not very good. But this is sort of what the spread looked like, in an artist's conception, anyhow. And that's that big mound in the middle there, in the commanding position. What's it called again?
Monk's Mound.
Monk's Mound. I can't remember Monk for some reason, but they certainly do. And what are some of the features? That's like, so it's like an inner walled city, basically. And with that mound in the center of it, and all kinds of other mounds spread all out, far and wide, and something in the center of the center that's kind of a clock or a calendar.
So in that artist's depiction, they're showing a chunky ground in the center in that plaza area.
Oh, that's where they played then.
Yeah, and
how
the
about that?
Clock is on the woodhenge, the circle of wooden posts have had astronomical significance is on the edge.
Woodhenge.
And there's woodhenge. And there's something really interesting about the wall around Cahokia. So this was a city that really kind of exploded on the scene around AD 1050. And it wasn't walled. And the wall wasn't erected until the late 1100s or after AD 1200, and then it was built only around the central precinct.
Any records of a early Trump tribe?
You know, I've always thought that it was built to kind of protect the elites, to provide this sort of inner sanctum for those people who were the leaders and their close relatives.
Yeah. Trump would have been Trump, I think, in those days.
Trump.
Anyways, and these walls are unique in the sense of
they're built out of substantial sized posts that would have been pretty similar to the size of telephone poles today. So the engineering in cutting down the quantity of wood necessary to construct these.
We notice there are no trees remaining in this.
You know, that is usually how artists end up depicting these sites, but I'm not entirely sure that it is the case. Uh-huh. In part because in our excavations, when we find trash pits that have food remains in them, we find a fair amount of nutshell. Could be squirrels, but if you don't have any trees nearby, those squirrels are carrying those nuts many kilometers.
Yeah.
So the nuts were important as a food resource, and so it very well may be the case that groves of trees and squirrels as well.
Yeah. And besides, we're the ones that denuded the landscape, not the Cahokians.
They actually... So hundreds of years before Cahokia became a thing, the floodplain that Cahokia is situated in began going into that floodplain and clearing trees and opening up the landscape for gardens. And so that began around AD 450, and by AD 600, the landscape had been really changed. They had cut down a lot of trees, not all trees, but a lot in order to establish pretty extensive agricultural fields. And they weren't really, we don't have evidence that they were living in the floodplain in high numbers. They may have been living in upland settings, but farming in the floodplain in these really rich soils. And that, continued to be intensified after Cahokia's rise, or as Cahokia rose.
All right. In the course of this, Cecil, do you feel you know any individual Cahokians? You've run into some remains, probably. Anything? Do you feel like you know anybody there?
You know, there's one particular mound at Cahokia that was pretty intensively excavated in the early 1970s, and that's Mound 72. And a large number of individuals were buried in Mound 72. In one of the most intensively studied of those individuals was an adult male who was laid out on a blanket of marine shell beads, hundreds and hundreds of beads made out of marine shell from the Gulf Coast. And the way that blanket was laying on the ground, as the archaeologists found it, it actually looked like a bird. The hood, it may have been a cape. And so he's been called the bird man for many, many years. And it, you know, people have looked at him as, you know, possibly the chief or some very early leader in the community whose burial context expressed particular beliefs about this society and gives us insights into who that person was as an individual. And there are some bioarchaeologists who are doing some very interesting kind of individual biographies by really intensively looking at the ancestral remains of particular individuals. And a fair amount of this has been happening in Central America, where you've got writing that actually records the name of the individual who's in a tomb, and sometimes even records their exploits. Mm-hmm. And so in the Maya world, some bioarchaeologists have been doing a kind of physical biography to accompany the textual biography.
Can they do genome?
So that's possible. Study? If it depends on the preservation of genetic material in the skeletal remains.
Yeah, because so you find out where they came from.
It's tricky, but it there is some. It's kind of tricky. I mean, most of the studies that have been done have demonstrated that there was actually quite a bit of movement of people and quite a bit of, you know, intermarriage. There wasn't the sort of population isolation that we sometimes model as archaeologists, especially when we create maps where we draw lines around an area and say, okay, this is the Cahokia area, and we draw a line around it. And then we, you know, have the Etowah area over here, and we draw a line around it.
But it was the hub, really, of this amazing culture.
It really was.
That spanned half the country, half of our current country.
Certainly, its influence extended across, you know, into the Great Plains, into the Southeast, maybe even into the Upper Midwest. It really had a lasting legacy effect. And the early Spanish who came through the Southeast encountered people across the Southeast who were living a way of life that we as archaeologists would refer to as Mississippian. Mm-hmm. They describe the mounds, they describe chiefs, they describe pearls and other ornaments, all of the things that we find in an archaeological context. Mm-hmm. The Spanish descriptions bringing to life for us and help us build analogies that bridge the incomplete material record that we have to say something about people's life ways.
Amazing. But the nuts and bolts of it, what they believed, what they practiced, religious or otherwise, what they thought about things there, using artwork that showed something more was happening around them, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have really any of that.
That's really difficult to get at. We know a lot about the foods that they ate. We know a lot about the technology, how they made tools, how they made ornaments, how they made...
Because they didn't leave a written record of anything.
There's no written record.
Like the Egyptians did, paint their walls with their achievements.
No written records about how they lived their lives at all. So the only thing that we can rely on to learn something about this amazing ancient culture are the stone tools, the fragments of pottery, the bits and pieces of food remains that mostly burned or otherwise preserved. And that's kind of the abundance of what we find.
And we can't just leave the poop where it is.
No.
We've got to pick up on this. What the poop? Now, this is, you were part of this, and this is A.J. White.
Yes,
mentioned, who was in Berkeley.
Yes, he was at CSU Long Beach as a master's student when he got interested in doing this study. Mm-hmm. And he's now a graduate student at Berkeley. And working with another scientist, Sam Munoz, and then Jack Williams. Sam was a graduate student here at UW-Madison. Jack Williams was with us, was his advisor in geography. They had pulled a sediment core out of Horseshoe Lake, this large lake that's adjacent to Cahokia, and had examined it for paleoenvironmental information. And this is how...
As one would.
As one would. Yeah. You know, that's what everybody does when they look at muck from the bottom of a lake. So AJ knew about that study, and he was interested in seeing whether or not there would be evidence of what are called fecal stanols, these molecules that are the residual of human poop that has ended up in the watershed. And he...
What do you say in the field, I mean, not in the field, or when you're speaking to a group, let's say, you don't call it poop, you just use it.
Well, feces, fecal material.
Yeah, it's kinda, and, you know, it's, you can't get around it, really.
You can't really get around it. Okay. And depending upon the audience that I'm talking to, they don't know what feces are.
So
I just call it poop.
Why was it finding this fecal matter so important in such an enlightening thing?
So it was so important because we had a really great paleoenvironmental record. And now we could get fecal stanols out of different layers and look at the relative change in population size within the watershed in relationship to things like land clearance, flood episodes, changes in seasonality of rainfall. So we could tie very nicely and pretty closely changes in population to changes in the paleoclimate. And that's something that, you know, has interested archaeologists for a long time, but we're usually working with archaeological evidence that is terrestrial in origin, that's come from land, and we're working from a paleoenvironmental record that has come from the bottom of a lake. And we're using radiocarbon dates to try and tie the paleoenvironmental record to the archaeological record. And radiocarbon dates.
I'm with you on this. Yeah. I get it. Our poop is going to leave a record of us and our times, some of our biggest achievements, I might add. And what exactly, though, by dating, what are you dating, and why does that dating tell you what the environment was like exactly?
So the paleoenvironmental materials that we look at to figure out what kinds of plants were growing in the area, particularly trees, is pollen. Small grains of pollen that get embedded in the sediments in the bottom of lakes. And then sometimes we get charcoal. If there were, you know, forest fires in particular, we'll get charcoal in those lake layers.
And you can date all that?
And we can date the charcoal, and we can date some other terrestrial remains that have ended up in
the carbon stuff.
The carbon stuff. We can get dates on that. And so, you know, we have a layer of sediment, and we know what the pollen composition of that layer is, and maybe we've gotten a few radiocarbon dates, and then we've got another layer a little bit higher where we've gotten some radiocarbon dates, and we use statistical modeling, and this is something that Sam did as part of his dissertation research to create an age model for the entire core. And AJ took a second core.
How many ages did that particular poop encompass?
So the poop record spans hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years.
Yes, yes.
And that's all they could produce in hundreds of years. They were bound up, these people. That's something we should talk about. No, that's amazing.
It's a really extraordinary study.
Yeah, I've never been so excited about poop before in my life. Well, sometimes you get that way. You know,
But it was
amazing.
Yeah, just it was a really
it's just
fun,
beginning. This is science just beginning.
Yeah, yeah. Basically. So this is AJ's work has really demonstrated the feasibility of this method in a temperate environment. Mm-hmm. Previous studies had applied the method in Arctic environments, where the preservation of these molecules is much better because of the cold. And it just worked remarkably well for the Cahokia area.
Yeah, and so the. I hate to say the upshot, but it's the only word I know for that word. It seems to be right now that climate change was a major factor in the ending of this civilization.
It certainly appears that, because we've got evidence of a major flood, the first flood in hundreds of years.
This is biblical. This is all biblical, too.
And it has that kind of proportion. And the population is high before the flood, and after the flood, it's lower than it was at any time in our record prior to the flood.
If there were an ark on top of that mound, this would be a revelation.
I guess it would be, Michael. That would be really something. It would move the whole origin story to
something we could believe.
It's really amazing. And then after the flood, we've got oxygen isotopes that suggest that warm season drought became an issue. So if you think about a society that's really based on genealogy, personal relationships, a connection between the leader and the cosmos, and an unprecedented event like a flood happens. And that's the kind of event that might cause doubt in the minds of people in their leader and their leader's ability to lead them forward after this.
Or just the facts of life. We can't grow anything anymore.
Right.
There's nothing to eat. We got to go look for it.
And the occupation of Cahokia does continue after this great event, but many people are leaving. They're fleeing, and we see around the same time in the archaeological record, that's when the walls are built around the central precinct. Evidence of
social disorder.
Maybe these climatological events happened at a time when a leader had died and there was uncertainty about who was genealogically appropriate to follow and inherit that leadership position, or maybe there was infighting over who should inherit the leadership position. Yeah. And so if you start to put these social and political factors and the economic challenges that people faced when, food resources were affected by the flood, together with the climate, it begins to build a package that shows that the climate had an impact. And some people chose to leave the Cahokia area in the wake of those climatic events. Some people chose to stay, but the way they lived their lives changed in some regard.
Oh, amazing. Professor, I'm going to call you Professor. I just have two questions for you. Will
yes,
this
Michael.
Be on the final?
It'll be an extra credit question.
And do I get credit for this? Because I can. You know, I'm old enough now where I can just come in and sit in the class. But
yes.
I would like to get credit for this.
Yes,
possible.
You can audit.
Social Security credit would be
Social
ideal.
Security credit would be the best.
Thank you so much, Cecil.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
This is amazing. And, I knew nothing about Cahokia, but I told you, the woman I talked to said field trips all the time. And then she said, I really didn't know all this other stuff about it. They may need to cover the material better on those field trips.
Yes, I think you might be right about that. We have this remarkable city.
It's amazing.
In the middle of our country. And
it's like having a pyramid in town.
Yeah, it should be as well known as ancient Egypt, Rome. Should be as well known as all of these other major urban centers elsewhere in the world.
Thank you so much. From UW Anthro, Professor Cecil Schrader, with a startling news about Cahokia.
Thank
I was
you.
Startled. Thank you so much. That was wonderful.